board with 50% Aboriginal people in place on it. So it's sort of like a para-political negotiation, and that this management board is going to fit into the structure of government that we will hopefully complete negotiations on over the next few years. So the claims process fits very well into this whole process, and we're hoping to make a number of other agreements that would have protection by legislation and by the fact that the Canadian Constitution as well recognizes Aboriginal rights, even though they say they don't know what it is. One of the things that the new government of Canada, the federal government, has undertaken is to review what you call the claims policy. That is, they're reviewing those things that they think are negotiable through the claims process. And I mention this because it's important to recognize that the extinguishment policy that I guess went through the United States and as well Southern Canada is making its last stop in Northern Canada, because they've extinguished everybody else, and they're just the Inuit and the Métis and the Dene to go. And we're hoping to make a last stand, so to speak. And there's a number of scenarios being developed by people in Canada that object to this whole policy. And for us, what the government wants to do is to say, well, we don't know what your rights are, so why don't we just make it very simple for all of us and just say, let's agree to extinguish all of them, whatever they are. And then in exchange, we will give you back some rights. We'll give you back land rights, rights to some compensation, hunting rights, trapping rights. And that's basically the policy. And I know, Doug, you talked about it here, but I think we did last year. The whole idea that we have of Aboriginal rights is that it's everything. It's all the rights you have as a nation, but it just stops a few inches short of total sovereignty. And that's just because of the political realities of living in a nation state. And that if we should say that too often, we would probably all be political prisoners. But again, that's the difficulty we have in negotiating with the federal government. And one of the analogies that we use is to say, we go to the negotiating table with a full box, and we don't know what all of the rights are in that box, but we know it's a full box. What the Canadian government says is, it's an empty box, and what we're going to negotiate with you is what rights we're going to throw in there for you. And that's the impasse that we have. And as well, as someone said, or was relating to earlier, the rights to make a living, to survive as a distinct people, is not negotiable, and that what we need to do is to make sure that the government accepts that very well. But it's also complicated by the fact that under law, under the Charter of Rights, there is no recognition or definition of what is we term as the rights of a collective. It is the rights that we have to our land. As someone said earlier, you can't own it as an individual, but in law you can't the government is not capable of recognizing that we as an Aboriginal people have a collective right to a certain area of land. So we have some difficulty with that as well. And you know, some of the laws that are being considered by our territorial government, and it's again kind of unbelievable, I guess, but they just are presently proposing to pass a human rights code which recognizes individual rights but makes absolutely no mention other than that they will respect whatever Aboriginal rights are recognized in the future. But what that threatens to do is that anybody who feels threatened about the collective hunting rights of our people, for instance, and feel that they're being discriminated against, can take our entire agreements, whatever agreements that we have that give us a collective hunting rights or the rights as a collective people to own certain areas of land, that legally that would be thrown right out the window. So it's a whole series of things that that we have difficulty with. And I think, as with other people in the world as well, I mean, part our worst problems are, you know, some of our own people. That is, we spend a lot of time, I think, fighting each other. It's not only across Canada, it's right at home. For some reason, I guess historically, we don't get along that well with the Inuit, you know, but we have only everything to gain by working together, but for some damn reason we just can't do it, you know. And that the whole idea that, you know, all we have is ourselves, and that, you know, if we don't do something together fairly soon, then we're going to lose this opportunity to define things for ourselves and to rearrange those institutions and those governments that are offensive to us at this time. But that the government is not denying us that process. It's our own people. You know, it's as Aboriginal people, we just can't seem to get along. And, you know, the personal politics between ourselves is, I think it's kind of pathetic, I guess, but for people that are involved, you know, it's very real. But for some reason, I guess, maybe the law of conformity too as well, you know, some of us start to get too uppity or too well known, then our own people turn against us because, you know, the law of conformity, I guess, is very strong in our culture. So the process is all there. I mean, we've done our homework, you know. We made this declaration a number of years ago. We followed up on it, and, you know, these things are happening now. But, you know, we're spending a great deal of time fighting amongst ourselves too, and I think that's the difficulty that I find. I think that we, in the Western world anyway, the Dene and the Inuit, the Métis, have carved out the beginnings of a very comfortable place. But it looks like, you know, the petty politics and the racism or whatever you want to call it that exists between us is the one thing that is threatening to deny us of it. So those are the comments I wanted to make about where I come from. So I'd like to thank you for your time and for listening.
Thanks very much, Steve. I think that that's what's known as good news and bad news. And we all hope that this is a temporary interruption of what has been a most hopeful period in Northern Canada. We know that folks like you will, I'm sure, be able to improve the situation that has now stalled that progress. Well, I think that this would be a good time to stop for lunch and to come back at 1:30, and then let us just discuss the whole subject of self-determination for Native people, the standards that ought to guide us. And I'll ask Raina to open the discussion, but it will, and Raina insists upon this, be very much one of give and take, and that should be a very useful way in which to end our deliberations. So let's make it 1:30. Let's take our seats, shall we?
Is it okay if you get in the round table today, or?
Well, we really really don't have very much time, just a couple of hours, so I...
Yeah, well, what I want to do is get this identification, because everybody is overreacting to the white, you know. I'm an indigenous Polak, one generation removed from my white rights entirely, and no guy has to be apologize to anybody for being white, you know, because...
No, that point doesn't have to be made.
Okay.
Maybe some other people are on
the right. Oh, don't worry about it. Well, since we're since this is the last session and we just have a couple of hours, and we were going to just chat informally, maybe Moses Guard and Moana and you would like just to come up and sit at the table, and all of you, and since this is really the last gasp, and Tony Vasquez is here. He's participated in our round tables before, and Tony, please take a seat. Doug Sanders is gone for the... he's had to leave, and so please feel... Well, we're yeah, we'll do the best we can. Well, Raina, you wanted to start off, and I was eager that you should do so, and so let's just carry on. I think that...
Well, I didn't want to start off so much as I just would like to see if we can have a a genuine conversation. God, I don't want to say dialogue, that's so overused, but a genuine conversation among the people here about some of the issues that have come up over the last few days and some of the issues that I'm sure have inevitably come up every time the commission has met, wherever they've met. And I suppose some of them have come up in the last, really in the last couple of hours. I personally would like to thank Steve for a presentation this morning that I thought was enormously provocative. And in that presentation, he raised a number of issues which I think really offer us a frame for dialogue within the framework of some issues that we've raised earlier. For example, the whole issue of native models for governance, for education, native models for the administration of the welfare of our people, native models for decisions about who is native and who is not, native models for decisions about the way we run our lives, about the way we get our food, the way we protect our land, and so forth. And I really want to thank Steve for that. I'm particularly impressed by what I think is absolutely revolutionary and what Dene Nation has done in opening its membership to the people who belong to the Dene Nation and not accepting governmentally imposed standards of who should belong to the nation. I think that's an issue that we might talk about. We might talk about issues like that in a number of different contexts. For example, the whole issue which arises with ANCSA about descendants' rights seems to me primary. And I know Rosita and a number of others have raised that repeatedly. Again, this is an issue that really centers around who defines us and how we define our world and who controls that definition. With ANCSA, it's quite clear that that definition was imposed by outside as to who shall continue to have control over land and over resources, and I think that's an issue that ought to come up. Other issues which I think are compelling are the issues that a number of us have raised before, which have to do with the arena of law and policy and so forth. Most particularly, I guess the context I'd frame it in is, so what? You know, so what if the law does this? So what if policy does that? Are there issues that reside out of that arena? Oren raised one most provocatively this morning, although he didn't go with his line of comment in the way I thought he was going to take it. I'm very grateful to him for raising the issues, for example, of transnational corporations. And the so what question I would like to pose, perhaps for some discussion, is if the United States nor any power can no longer control transnational corporations, what difference does it make what laws they make about natives if they can't even control these other institutions? Do they offer a model for us, perhaps, either in collaboration with them or in actions against them or in actions apart from them that have any relevance to our lives? I'm very grateful to Robert Goldwyn for suggesting that we link up with transnational terrorism. I'm quite compelled by that notion. Perhaps somebody will want to explore that.
Suggest that.
But you let that particular cat out of this particular bag.
Well, I know you are both speaking in jest, so.
Yes. But it certainly is provocative. Well, I raise some of these issues all in the context of the possibility for having a discussion about, not about the past and about the way tradition operated in the past, if the past is only used as a glowing, fond memory of what we think ought to be, but to use the past and to use tradition and to use the projection of native models as a gloss, perhaps, on the future, and to see if we cannot talk about what ought to be and what needs to be by way of what we know we are and what we can do and what we have done, without a tedious and unnecessary, I think, total reliance on what we've been given, you know, rights given to us, laws given to us, structures imposed on us. I don't wish to raise the possibility of talking about cloud cuckoo land. I don't think that's the kind of thing we're raising here, but rather, what might we learn from ourselves in order to teach our own children and to teach others? And I say teach not just in the context of education as it's narrowly understood, but in a much larger arena of governance, leadership, economic growth, healthcare, and all those arenas which do concern us. So with that, I...
Okay, thank you, Raina. Did you want to carry on, Verna, from there?
I wish that maybe Raina would pick one particular area. You know, I know there's been a lot of talk on the categorization of Indian people, and I don't think there is any as bad as there is in Canada, really, in terms of the categorization of people, because I think the people here are all well aware of the fact that the Native women in Canada, many Native women in Canada are no longer classified or regarded as Native in terms of the legal sense. And there has been an ongoing battle for a long time to have that changed. And on the other hand, there are many people who have no Indian blood whatsoever who are legally considered Indians in our country. And I think that's just about the ultimate mistake in what's going on. And I've heard around the table that there are many, you know, other categorizations of people. It makes it so difficult to talk about our people in our country because we're talking about status Indians, non-status Indians, Métis people. You know, we have so many different categories, and yet I really wonder about this issue. In Canada, the issue seems to be, well, we'll change the Indian Act and allow, no longer have this apply to Native women, you know, that they should lose their status. And then the question is, well, how far back do we go in reinstating the Indian women? You know, do we go all the way back? If we reinstate them and they marry non-Indians, then how far do we go in terms of blood in recognizing, let's say, their children, if they're mixed bloods, as Indian people? And then the argument goes, well, if we do all of those things and make a decision, the Indian bands themselves say, we want to decide who will have membership in our bands. Well, I don't think personally, I'll say that I'm in Alaska anyway, I don't think personally that Indian bands have any more right to decide who is Indian than anybody else. I think either you're Indian or you're not. And so, you know, there are, really it is a problem, and I would like to, you know, have some time spent on that too, you know, just hear some other comments.
I was going to say, I think this particular issue gets at the heart of one of the most primary issues facing Native people, and that is the right to determine who they are and to say, this is who we are, and not to have anyone else define define that issue. And the whole issue of descendants' rights and so forth, as I say with ANCSA, is going to be critical. If that basic, we've talked about all sorts of other rights, you know, human rights to liberty, human rights to, you know, to life and all, but the issue, the power and the liberty to define yourself is first in the most fundamental way. I think this is critical, absolutely critical.
David Case?
Let me say a couple of things to that point. With respect to what we've heard here, with particular regard to the Claims Act, the question came up, why did the Claims Act chop native stockholders' rights and ownership off at December 18, 1971? Ignoring for the moment that that's stockholding may not be a good idea in the first place. Why limit it to people born and alive on December 18, 1971? And the most telling comment to me, and I can only reflect my personal recollection, was Guy Martin's comment. And Guy Martin was the assistant to Gravel or somebody at the time. And he said that was the result, that was because that's what the bean counters wanted. The BIA, the bureaucracy, wanted to be able to determine who was going to get the money, who was going to be part of the settlement. And I think that mentality and that attitude is probably at the root of a lot of the government categorizations of Native people, an effort to limit the group of people to whom the government or whoever is going to be paying benefits, whatever form that may take. So I think your point is very well taken, that this is the definition of who is an indigenous person in the United States or Canada is decided on wholly wrong reasons. And that is a decision much better left to, I don't think it comes to the question maybe of whose values are being used here. I think it's a matter of the government wanting to limit that category of people who are going to be the beneficiaries of a treaty, if you can use the term beneficiaries, of a treaty or any particular program. And that's all I really have to say, sort of as my view of the background to that.
Sheldon?
Thank you, Justice Berger. I think it would be appropriate at this time for me, as chairman of the United Tribes of Alaska, to express what I hope are the feelings of Alaska's Native people, our village and tribal governments, an appreciation and a respect and a tremendous thanks to you, Thomas Berger, and to the Review Commission, all its staff, and everybody that has been instrumental in this entire process. In addition to this, I think it's also appropriate that on behalf of our Alaska Native people and the United Tribes of Alaska, that we would like to extend a formal invitation to not only the Review Commission and the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People, who sponsored the commission, an opportunity to present your final report and recommendations of the Review Commission to the second annual Congress of the United Tribes of Alaska. This is going to be a statewide gathering of village and tribal government delegates and leaders, and it is tentatively scheduled for the week of the 15th of September here in Anchorage at the Egan Civic Center. As I said earlier, this commission has provided an opportunity, a forum, very unique in the history of our people, for them to express their concerns, their views, their reservations about the impact of ANCSA on our lives, on our people, on our way of life. More than 1,400 Alaska Natives have testified. You have held hearings all over the state and even down so far as Seattle. And I had made the suggestion, and I hope that this suggestion will bear fruit in the final deliberations of this review commission before it does go into recommendations and its final report, that the Alaska Native Review Commission would hold at least one hearing in Washington, D.C. After all, we've heard from all parties that have been part of ANCSA, but this report, as far as the Native people are concerned, will not have the impact or the effect that we desire it to have if, in fact, that this message is not conveyed back to Congress and the federal government. You have asked in the introduction to this roundtable some very important questions that some of the participants have felt it necessary to reword. Questions such as, by what right did the white people come here and take our lands and make laws that say we must obey them? Others have said, by what right did Russia sell our land to the United States? How could these great powers hand our land over to the counter like a toy? The Alaska Native people, the people that hopefully I do represent as best I can, acknowledge that we cannot turn back the clock, but we are entitled to be treated fairly now and in the future. In talking with different people across the state, I have become very aware of different feelings that come from the heart, and I think they are most accurately reflected in the paper presented by Bishop DeRue when he quotes from the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Commission hearings, of which Justice Berger was commissioner, on statements made by Chief Frank Seeley of Fort Good Hope in 1928.
75, I think.
But the letter was written in 1928 by a Catholic priest.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
And this is, it's written in such a way to say that we as a people do not want to have to fight and struggle forever just to survive as a people. Your nation has the power to destroy us all tomorrow if it chooses to. It has chosen instead to torture us slowly, to take our children from us and teach them foreign ways and tell us you are teaching them to be civilized. Sometimes now we hardly know our children. You have forced us into communities and tried to make us forget how to live off the land so you could go ahead and take the resources that we trap and hunt and fish. You encourage us to drink liquor until we are half crazy and fight among ourselves. What else other than liquor is a territorial government willing to subsidize to make sure that prices are the same throughout the Northwest Territories? Does it subsidize fresh food or clothing or even pop in the same way? No, only liquor. The government knows very well that liquor helps keep my people asleep, helps keep them from realizing what is really happening to them and why. Personally, I have tried at the local level to do something about alcohol and alcohol abuse. And from personal experience of 17 years of trying to cope with alcohol, it dawned on me that you cannot preach to people with an alcohol problem. You have to show them by example the differences of what you can accomplish with alcohol and without. And I would like to point out that since I personally sobered up on the 12th of October, 1982, that I have managed to put myself in the position to where I can at least reflect my personal views on ANCSA, on the Native situation, and why I believe that alcoholism is not just a disease, but a symptom of a greater problem. And that problem has to do with the whole fabric of our Alaska Native people. And I would also like to commend you, Honorable Thomas R. Berger, because you have engaged in and undertaken a great challenge, one that faces all good people and their communities, assuring that the purpose and process of domestic democratic participation is achieved, that the access and opportunity for the broadest education and information is maintained. The Alaska Native people and the United Alaska await with great anticipation the final report of your commission. We hope the report truly reaffirms the dignity of our tribal people and tribal people all over the world, and our right to self-government and autonomy, and most importantly, that the recommendations will provide avenues for positive, constructive, and mutually acceptable resolutions to these differences. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kachetag. Thank you very much. Tony Vasca.
Thank you, Commissioner Berger. It seems to me that the exercise that we've been going through, and let me call it exercise for the moment, that we see the task of the commission is answerable to an entity called Inuit Circumpolar Conference. The discussions we've heard thus far over the last 2 years, at least the ones that I've heard, have dealt with a great variety of subject matter in terms of how Western nation states deal with either their indigenous populations or their minority groups. I don't know that we can point to a definition of what the United States identifies as a Native American. Obviously, if you look at the different tribes across the country, the United States has dealt with them separately and differently, so that in effect I think what you have is a hodgepodge of public policy towards Native Americans. I've said this before and I will say it again, the attempts by the United States Congress in Alaska are vastly different from the attempts by the U.S. Congress in, say, Oklahoma, or for that matter, South Dakota. Without the legitimacy that is needed to affect change by the U.S. Congress through whatever means, I think the exercise we're going through will be slow in coming about. We heard about the major changes in the world arena concerning how different nation states are dealing with their indigenous populations or with their different ethnic groups. From my perspective, I say that's fine. But who is going to afford a legitimacy to the needs or the wants of those indigenous groups or ethnic groups? It seems to me that without the consent of that nation state, whichever one it is, whether it's Canada or the United States, without a public policy consent to agree to major public policy changes, we've simply gone through an exercise that the major nation state will not recognize. Senator Ted Stevens, for instance, is not going to come to the Inupiat, Inuit Circumpolar Conference to say, well, I want to know what it is you guys are going to suggest to us so that I can enact new legislation, move into a treaty with Canada so that we have consistent policy recommendations and policy actions for the Inuit and other native populations in North America. He's simply not going to do that. The way the system presently works, he calls up somebody from AFN and gets a consent from there for affecting changes governing native peoples. So what we have in the last 14 years, and forgive me if I sound pessimistic, I don't intend to be, I'm meaning to point out what I see as facts and movements within the native community in the state. What it seems to me, what the state of Alaska, the sovereign state of Alaska, and the sovereign United States of America, when they want input for changes, they go find AFN and they go find AFN's lawyer or slew of lawyers and say, we're about to enact some changes that will have major impacts on you. What do you suggest we do to do that? They don't come to Elam or Unalakleet and say, Sheldon Kachetag, please, we would like to. We're going to make some major changes in how the United States government deals with tribal governing bodies, whatever they are. That simply doesn't happen. I think it's unfortunate that that doesn't happen, and many in a public position to enact those kinds of changes at least try to ask for a public forum whereby the United States and its different agencies is forced to listen to the citizens' views of what changes should be made. And it happens at all different levels. And obviously there are a lot of different issues you can point to where it does happen. The arena that I work in deals mostly with natural resources. So I'm most familiar with that, and I will try to use that as an example. But probably a more serious example that we have to face, and I'm not quite sure who the we is. It's a universal we that doesn't include anyone except myself. is, for instance, making a decision of membership in a tribal group. For all the legitimacy that's given to the United Tribes of Alaska, for instance, I've never had a vote to elect a tribal member to attend the United Tribes of Alaska meeting. I come from a community of 4,500 people. Approximately 50% of the population is a mixture of Alaska Natives. The town of Bethel, I believe, sends a representative to United Tribes, I'm not sure. But we've never had elections. We've never determined who constitutes that tribal entity. And if you look at the public policy directives by the United States government, it varies from one Indian group, from one tribal group, and sometimes in the same vicinity of people who consider themselves to be of the same tribe, there are differences in how the United States government deals with that. The problems that Canada face are vastly different, as we heard this morning and now this afternoon, about tribal membership. Those kinds of questions are not being dealt, for instance, by the recognized native leaders in this state. AFN's not going to say, come out and issue a directive and say, well, this is how all the Alaska Natives feel about tribal membership, and this is how they're going to define it. By the very fact that somebody back in 1971 agreed to a corporate system for determining membership in some organization, the corporations, they cut it off then. And I'm sure we've all heard the objections by many people of the fact that the tribal entity, again, whatever it is, I don't know what it is, the tribal entity and the tribal members are not being taken care of. For me, I think it's a simple matter of pointing out those things that causes a lot of problems. If in fact you go into the arena of the corporate structure of the Alaska Federation of Natives, anyone who thinks differently or even brings up the fact of United Tribes of Alaska is deemed undesirable in many ways, not in so many words. They might use words like radicals or dissidents, which simply labels other natives not being able to participate in that process that was set up 14 years ago. How this commission deals with that is of interest to me, and I presume of interest to many people in Alaska, both native and non-native. How that position will be forwarded to either the U.S. Congress or to the Canadian government is of interest to me. But I suspect that when our congressional delegation in the state of Alaska and the governor, whoever he is 2 years from now, will not come to Tony Vasca in Bethel, Alaska to define what that entity should be and how it should work. They will go to what they recognize as a legitimate spokespiece, mouthpiece for the Native community, and that's AFN. The importance of a different perspective on Alaska Natives does come from United Tribes of Alaska. And from my perspective, again, I'm willing to wait it out to see the kinks worked out so that it at least has a legitimacy from the base with which it says it represents. And that's the people in the and those are the people in the villages. That group of people is far more important to me as an individual than our members who are living in urban areas who say they represent those people in the villages. And those are the corporations, and by and large, all the corporations are here in Anchorage, or in the case of Doyon, in Fairbanks, or Sea Alaska and Juneau. They're not in Hoona, they're not in Teller, they're not in Ruby, they're not in Guigilno. They're in places where corporations will survive as corporations. And it seems to me that the rights given to corporations shadow pretty close to the rights given to individuals. And we have a lot of problems to work out. And what's going to happen, for instance, in a tribal community that defines its own members when one of the tribal members breaks the code of the